Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once, or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times Radio show, which you can listen to live Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. But it's nice to have you with us on the podcast. Thank you for listening and downloading, but also thank you to those of you who posted some nice comments on iTunes reviews recently. If you haven't done that yet, it'd be lovely to hear from you. You can post a comment or a suggestion or whatever, or just a rating. It does help with the old mumbo-jumbo charts, because there's a lot of political podcasts around now, and obviously Red Box has been around for some time now. And hopefully, all being well, there is now light at the end of the tunnel, or as the Prime Minister put it,
the crocus of hope is poking through the frost.
I mean, that just sounds like the worst chat-up line in the world, but it does mean that hopefully soon more of you will be back commuting and you'll be able to listen to the Red Box podcast every day as you head home from work. Anyway, enough of that. Coming up on today's episode, a brilliant interview with Chris Smith, the former Labour MP, the first MP to come out as gay, the first openly gay cabinet minister, and the first MP to come out as HIV positive. It's part of the series we've been doing, speaking to lots of politicians to mark LGBT History Month. That's coming up later in the episode. But first, because lots of you asked for it, you wanted to hear more from the Times columnists, like the old podcast, the columnists panel. So we kick off with Finkelfitch. It's Daniel Finkelstein and David Aronovich. Right then, let's get down to business. Is it okay to call someone Lady Macbeth if they are behaving a bit like Lady Macbeth? This is the big question. You know, so much coverage of Carrie Symons and the influence that she does or doesn't have over Boris Johnson. Is it too much? Is it unconstitutional? Is she doing anything wrong? Is she doing anything at all? Let's start with you, Danny.
I think if you're going to start asking whether the Shakespearean analogy is apt, you have to talk to David. My view is that insofar as Carrie Symons is an influence, she's been a wholly positive one. I think that the there's definitely a part of the change that's happened in Number 10 Downing Street that has occurred partly because of her opinion, but I think her opinion has been correct. I don't regard that as sinister. I think it is perfectly natural for a prime minister or any leader to look to their friends, whether they be their life partner or somebody else, for their opinion and to repose faith in it. And Carrie Symons is a political professional, a seasoned political professional whom I quite admire. So I think this has been a good move. I do wonder about where it leaves the Conservative Party in terms of political strategy. It has pursued one political strategy and now has a rather different political staff, and I wonder about that. But because the direction of travel has been away from advisers that I think were giving the Prime Minister questionable advice towards advisers I think will give the Prime Minister better advice, it's a good thing. I don't know the extent to which it was exclusively based on Carrie's advice. I think the stories that suggest that she was influential in it are correct, though.
I suppose, David, the Lady Macbeth question is that if she is just, just pursuing a different strategy, advising the other half that if the Conservative Party is going to be successful, then you need to do this differently. That's one thing. If it's to actually, to take the analogy all the way, to sort of assume power that she's not been, elected to, if you like, then that, and it all comes down to who's up and who's down and who she likes and who she doesn't. That's a slightly different question.
Yeah, I think the whole portrayal of this story as being, the story was great about the dog and all that sort of stuff. It was a great read. And of course, personal elements, they do play a role in these things. I've worked in, with loads of different number 10 teams and in Conservative Central Office. I know, of course, like in any office, personal factors play a role. But ultimately, this was about a political choice, about whether or not Boris Johnson wanted to retain a team who wanted to sort of carry on fighting the Brexit referendum through other means, or whether he wanted to choose a team that was going to kind of administer and help run a Conservative government. And I think he's chosen the latter of those two in a slightly chaotic way, which is his want, but definitely political as opposed to simply being a matter of personalities.
David, we never really heard quite so much about Philip May and his influence on Theresa May. He's a man, or just not as good at politics as Carrie?
Well, exactly. And I suppose the question you had to pose back to Danny is, suppose that he hadn't actually decided to go off with Carrie, but it was Jennifer Arcuri. Would you be equally satisfied with her advice being taken by the Prime Minister? The reason why I raised this in the first place, when we had a kind of little confab about what we would discuss today, was that this is an absolute perennial, which is you have a partner of a prime minister or a leader, and it's always applied to a woman partner to a male prime minister or a male leader, of whom it is said they are essentially Lady Macbeth, they are pulling all the strings, they have a kind of undue degree of influence. And there's a psychological element to this, which is the idea that the powerless woman expresses her power through pressure she places upon her man, and therefore, because it can't be democratic, it's somehow, in some kind of sense, illegitimate. And I was interested because I've seen this in so many emanations. You saw it with Cherie Blair, who would be attacked enormously. You obviously saw it with Hillary Clinton, who was a very powerful figure in the Clinton administration in her own right. You saw it even with Samantha Cameron, I seem to remember, Danny. This is one of the reasons why I thought you might have a commentary upon it. It's something to which people easily revert. Now, I guess Matt's point in this case is, yeah, but this time it's true.
That Sam Cameron was influential on David, and on issues like gay rights, or indeed the whole kind of liberal complexion of the Conservative government, or his appeal to the middle class. Right, there was no question about that. Anybody who saw them together could see that that was the case. It didn't mean that he wasn't the leader, but he definitely was the case. By the way, Marina Warder was very influential on Boris Johnson's decision to support Brexit. Everybody knows that that's true. I think Philip May's influence was sometimes overstated, actually, partly because I think Theresa was quite sort of withholding of political information and gossip, and even from Philip, I think. It's hard to be sure about that. So I think, all these relationships, they're inevitably influential. It's silly not to think that they are, but it doesn't make them wrong, and you can't remove them from life.
No, but hold on, Danny. There's a difference between, let's say, your philosophy of life being influential upon your partner, or your observation because you're a mother or a father or something like that, and you can observe the society around you, sometimes in a way that a leader can't, and being the person who effectively has a camp inside number 10, which you've got to belong to or not to belong to, which is you approve of or not approve of. That seems to me an entirely different kind of
influence. Yeah, but I don't think that is an incorrect description of the number 10 team. It's certainly an incorrect description of the relationship, for instance, between Dan Rosenfield and Carrie Simmons. I'm not even sure they knew each other at all before his appointment. It's an overstatement of the relationship between Henry Newman, one of these new advisors. It's just not the case that that sort of a kind of court of Carrie Simmons has set up camp inside number 10 dynasty. That is a massive overstatement. But is it the case, I believe it is, that she was of the view that he was getting advice that meant he wasn't being the prime minister that she sort of envisaged him as being? I think that is true. But I, by the way, think her view of that was accurate, actually. And of course, that influences my view about whether I think it's a good thing or not. I thought Sam Cameron's influence on David Cameron was a good influence, too. And insofar as I understand Dennis Thatcher's influence on Margaret Thatcher, I don't particularly think it was good influence, right? But I think it was sort of relatively limited. So
you mean the fact that he was an unrepentant the fact that he was an unrepentant racist?
Well,
that kind of stuff. No, it wasn't.
Let's not. I mean, if there are any hardcore Dennis Thatcher fans, I'm sure they'll get in touch. Let's move on and talk about lockdown. And in particular, overnight, YouGov, in fact, quite quickly yesterday afternoon, YouGov did a snap poll asking people, this is specifically in England that they got the results back from, asking people if they support the speed with which Boris Johnson is reopening the economy and the pace of lifting the lockdown. And the thing that, 46% said it was about right, 26% said he's going too fast, 16% say he's going too slowly. Only 20% of Conservative voters say he's going too slowly. And the thing that it struck me was that the anti-lockdowners get an awful lot of coverage and make an awful lot of noise, but they don't appear to have an awful lot of support. Even after all this time, only 16% think he's going too slowly. David, does this surprise you?
It does a little, actually, but that may be because I'm too influenced by what I see on Twitter and hear in what the papers say when they report what the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph have been saying. Because this has been a pretty consistent thing, right? Well, because you just wonder at what point it was going to have some kind of an impact. It's very funny, really, because, and Danny will have had this experience as well, you get somebody suddenly tweeting saying, you know, in supporting this lockdown, etc., as if it was something we're kind of doing because for the fun of it, because we like it, etc. We've had this discussion before. You're going against where the vast majority of British people are. And you turn back to them and say, you know what, there's no evidence that's the case. Actually, all the evidence seems to be that we're pretty much on line with the British people. And then they say, what do they say? You know what they say. They say, who says so? And you say, polling evidence. They say, who conducts the polls? And then you're off on one. I think it's partially because there's such a kind of hermetically sealed set of arguments amongst the kind of what they call lockdown sceptics that they aren't actually very much in touch with what ordinary people think. One of the things I was struck by was when Matt Hancock was talking about the 10-year possible jail sentence for having declared yourself wrongly to have been in a country that had a variant in it. The polls seemed to suggest that most British people thought that wasn't harsh enough. And it did kind of make you wonder, if you'd asked them if they had the death penalty for it, they wouldn't have signed up for that as well.
Yeah,
and that's
possibly.
Always the thing, isn't it, Danny?
I remember when I...
No, go on, Danny.
Yes, look, when I was working in the last days of the SDP, we had a by-election candidate who he used to keep his front tooth in his top pocket and only take it out for press conferences, and he couldn't remember any of the policies of the party. And after he was briefed, he'd forget them. And David Owen said to him, I tell you what, just think of the toughest thing that you can think of when you're asked a question, and say that. He said, I can always dial us back from there. I always think of that whenever I see a poll like this. It's not that surprising. And the British people will always take a pretty tough line, particularly where their security or personal integrity is concerned, right? They expect government to make the correct judgments. They don't necessarily expect, actually, that the government will follow every kind of prejudice and instinct that they have themselves, but they still have them. And I think the 10-year thing was pretty revealing, right? I did actually think it was a bit. I'm a friend of Matt Hancock's, but I did think it was a bit mad. To be honest. Yeah. But I wasn't that surprised to discover that people, you know, people's attitude to that is, well, you shouldn't do it then, right? And then it won't be a problem. I think that the rule of law and sentencing has to be a bit more subtle than that, but that is people's view, right? It's a bit like their view about the vaccine. When people complain that it's against their liberty, they have to take it, they go, well, that's your lookout, mate, right? And I think that is a very widespread attitude, and often the view on, for example, social media was wildly out of sync with public view.
I suppose that's, and actually, at least the ten year sentencing, it did sort of hammer home the point that people are, while people are having the argument, everyone else got the message: don't lie about where you're going on your holidays. And it, you know, in that sense, it served its purpose. Just finally, because I'm really interested in this as well, David. We're sort of now at the point where Joe Biden has got his feet under the desk. He's in the Oval Office. He's obviously found where the Oval Office is. We thought that we were told he was senile. He couldn't possibly run a major global economy. Any evidence of that so far?
Well, it was very interesting because back at the time that he was running against Bernie Sanders, there was a whole kind of spate of stories that didn't just emerge from the Trump people, or speculations, not stories, rather, that actually there was evidence that he was senile, that he was mildly demented, etc. And you looked at this, you thought, well, I can't see the evidence for this. But actually, because we're all in lockdown, I can't really see the evidence for much at all. So it was kind of difficult to say, and I wasn't sure where they were getting their information from. I just wanted to mark this moment after Biden has made several speeches, several interventions, to say it is painfully obvious not only that he doesn't suffer from dementia and he isn't going senile, but that actually he is an incredibly astute political leader as of now. I cannot think of a single foot that he politically has put wrong or a single wrong note that he has delivered since he was elected back in November on each and every stage. And that is a pretty remarkable record.
Yeah, that's, of course, dependent on whether we think he's correct or not, David. But I would, you know, but I broadly do. So I broadly agree with that view. I never thought that he could be suffering from dementia, because in American politics, you haven't published your health records to too great an extent. But I do think there will be a question over his period in office whether the energy that has sustained Joe Biden throughout his career will be there. But I also agree with David. I think the evidence so far is pretty encouraging. I was, you know, very strongly of the view that he should be elected. And it's certainly not a view, not, you know, even taking Donald Trump out of the equation, that I resolve from. I think that kind of centrist leadership that he offers is, you know, is good leadership. And I think it's proving it.
And the other thing, Kamala Harris, obviously some of the Republicans trying to whip up, well, it's Kamala Harris is the one who's going to be running the show, really. And actually, she seems to have taken the sort of traditional, you know, not quite backseat, but, you know, the correct and proper role of the vice president. You know, she pops up occasionally, she appears alongside him, but she's clearly not out there making all the noise, doing lots of interviews and things that you might have expected.
Since Mondale, there has been an increase in who was Carter's vice president. There's been an increase in the influence of the vice president. And at times it's peaked, as it did under Dick Cheney, where he really was, you know, pretty much the kind of prime minister in the Bush administration on some issues, foreign security issues, right? But that is unusual. She is much closer to the norm, and that was always likely to be the case, unless the more lurid theories about Joe Biden were right, and I never thought that was the case.
Yeah, I mean, firstly, there's an enormous amount of work to do, and there's an enormous amount of work to do in the Senate, etc., and I'm sure that she's pretty active doing it, and that she has her own kind of significant areas of responsibility, which she'll only just be getting to grips with. But isn't it interesting as well how she becomes, for the right in America, also very easily a Lady Macbeth figure, although even worse, more insidious, a black Lady Macbeth. Which is kind of, you know, the scariest kind of Lady Macbeth you can possibly get.
It's Daniel Finkelstein and David Ivanovich there. And of course, you can read them every week in the Times. Just get yourself a Times subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/Times Red Box. Up next, that extraordinary interview with Chris Smith.
Past Imperfect with Rachel Sylvester and Alice Thompson, a weekly series of in-depth interviews with high-profile figures examining how overcoming the challenges of their early lives shaped the people they've become. This week, Booker Prize-winning author Douglas Stewart talks candidly about coping with his mother's alcoholism and being gay in 80s working-class Glasgow.
I was attacked very violently when I was 15, and actually it was an old Glaswegian housewife who was driving by. She thought they were stamping on a dog and so stopped her car and got out and chased these boys away, and at the centre of it was me.
Past Imperfect with Rachel Sylvester and Alice Thompson. Douglas Stewart, in his own words. Now available as a podcast. Listen on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Now, my interview with Chris Smith. Way back in the 1980s, with the words, "My name is Chris Smith, I'm the Labour MP for Islington South and I'm gay," he became the first out MP. Decades later, he became the first out gay cabinet minister and then the first MP to acknowledge that he was HIV positive. I've been talking to him and I started by asking him about when he decided to come out publicly.
I'd been first elected to the House as the MP for Islington South and Finsbury in 1983. I had made no particular secret of the fact that I was gay before I was elected. Virtually all of my constituency party knew that I was gay, but I'd never said anything publicly on a public platform. And I sort of thought, having been elected, I thought at some point I really do need to stand up and say something about myself. It was partly because there were one or two colleagues who were gay, who weren't out, who were being hounded by the press, who had reporters sitting in cars outside their flat all night. Their dustbins were rummaged, all sorts of harassment going on. I just decided the way to avoid all of that is to remove the story. And you remove the story by telling it yourself. And so I had made up my mind that at some point I needed to stand up and say something. But the crucial question was when would the right moment actually be? And it's also worth remembering I had a wafer-thin majority. I was elected with a majority of 363 votes in 1983. I eventually got it up to over 15,000, but it was wafer-thin at that point. The occasion came about a year later. It was the city of Rugby in the Midlands had changed political control, and the incoming leader of Rugby Council had said that he was going to remove sexual orientation from the list of things they would not discriminate against in their employment policies. So effectively, he was saying, I do not want to have LGBT people coming to work for Rugby Council. And understandably, a lot of people were upset about this. There was a big march and rally called on a Saturday lunchtime. And because I had said supportive things about LGBT rights up to that point, they invited me to go up and speak. So I can remember going up on the train and writing this very boring speech on my way up. But then walking into the hall where the meeting was taking place, there were about 1,000 people in the hall. The meeting had already started. And as I walked up through the audience to take my seat on the platform, I just suddenly thought, this is the moment to do it. Because the issue here at stake is the ability for anyone, no matter what their sexual orientation happens to be, to do an equally good and valid job working for Rugby Council as anyone else. And actually, exactly the same applies to MPs. And I went and sat on the platform. It was about 10 minutes before I was due to speak. I have hardly ever been as scared as I was in that moment. My knees were almost literally knocking together. And I stood up and I began my speech by saying, my name's Chris Smith, I'm the Labour MP for Islington, South and Finsbury, and I'm gay. At which point, I have to say, the audience got to its feet and gave me a standing ovation. It's the only time I've ever had a standing ovation less than 1 minute into a speech. I have to say, never regretted that moment for a single minute ever since.
What was it that made you so nervous before doing it? And was that then borne out by the reaction later, subsequently?
The reason I was nervous was I had no idea what the general reaction, not just in the hall, but the general reaction from the public, from my constituents, from the press, was going to be. Because, of course, no one had ever done this before, voluntarily stood up and said this. So I was taking a huge leap into the unknown. In fact, the immediate response, there was some press coverage, most of it factual. Subsequently, some of the tabloids had a go over the course of the following month or two. By and large, it was reasonably factual and impartial. I had letters from people all around the country. Now, this was way back in 1984, so long before the days of social media. So I had letters, and a lot of them said, good on you, congratulations, well done. I think the letters that meant the most to me, though, were the ones that said, thank you for doing this. It's made it easier for me. And that, the fact that perhaps by standing up and saying something about myself and generating publicity because of that, I may have helped uncertain, nervous young people around the country to have more courage and confidence themselves. I hope that may have done some good.
And what was it like when you went back to the House of Commons, not a place known to always be at the forefront of modern Britain? I mean, the very building is, you know, sort of is old fashioned, and the procedures and so on. And as a result, some of the views, you know, what was it like going back to the House of Commons of 1984? What reaction did you have?
It was interesting. From most of the people I came across, a lot of support. Neil Kinnock was the leader of the Labour Party at the time. He went out of his way to seek me out and give me support and offer any help that that I needed. Most of my colleagues were very positive. A number sort of avoided my eyes when I passed them in the corridor. One or two gave me a cold shoulder. One or two said, this is not the sort of thing we ought to be talking with our working class voters about. There were interesting responses from across the political divide. I'll never forget a wonderful moment. Edwina Currie, who was actually a very firm supporter of LGBT equality through her time in the Commons. I was queuing in the members' tea room to get a cup of tea. Lots of MPs sitting around all over the place. Edwina came marching in, and in a very loud voice, she said, "Chris, I hear you've come out. Well done." And turned on her heel and marched out again. I sort of felt like hugging her at that point.
Last week, we had Chris Bryant was on the show. He was speaking to my colleague, Luke Jones, and he described some of the experience that he'd had as a gay MP in the House of Commons. Let's take a listen.
Well, one person who is very senior in the House still today, I remember telling me that I was a disgrace and shouldn't be an MP because I was gay. I remember a doorkeeper telling me that he wouldn't open a door for me because I was gay. Now, I mean, all of these things have, for the most part, changed, but they haven't entirely, I think. I remember one MP telling me that he had been taking bets with journalists about when I would commit suicide when I got into trouble with the Mail on Sunday back in 2003.
That was the Labour MP Chris Bryant speaking to Times Radio last week. Chris Smith, did you ever experience anything like what Chris was describing last week?
I didn't have anything as extreme as he experienced. And that may be the context in which it all happened so on. I do remember one very significant moment, though. It was when we were debating all the issues around Section 28, which came a few years after I'd come out publicly. Now, you have to remember, at this point, I was the only openly gay member in the Commons. It was one of the debates on Section 28. Nicholas Winterton, the Tory, very right-wing reactionary Tory, was making a speech. A rather homophobic speech. I stood up to intervene on him at one point, and I made a point and I sat down again. And he looked across the chamber at me. And before he responded, he said, "The House has learned to listen to the Honourable Gentleman with respect when he talks about these issues. But," and he then went on to disagree with me. I remember thinking at that point, the fact that he felt he had to say that, and remember all of this was on the Hansard record, the fact he felt he had to say that showed we had made a tiny little bit of progress. That here he was talking about LGBT people in the abstract, but suddenly there was one of them sitting there in front of him. And he had to acknowledge that fact.
This is Matt Chorley speaking to Chris Smith on Times Radio. Now, Chris, we always need to be very careful to say that you were the first out gay MP, clearly not the first gay MP. There would have been many others through the history books, but felt they weren't able to be public about their sexuality for whatever reason, the society pressures of the time. Once you had gone public, were there other MPs who weren't out who came to you and said that they were concerned about what would happen if they were public about their sexuality?
There were certainly a number of MPs who were gay, who were worried about what would happen if they did come out, who sought my advice. My advice was always to them, it is absolutely better to be open than not. Yes, it was probably easier to do this as the MP for an inner London seat than perhaps other parts of the country. But nonetheless, it was something where actually you would find people respected you for being open, for being honest, for being candid, for putting it out into the public light of day. But I would always add, it is absolutely your choice. You don't have to do it. If you're too nervous about it, then don't. Because you have to be confident in yourself because it won't all be a bed of roses. There will be criticism. There will be homophobia. There will be insults that are hurled at you. You have to be confident enough to live through all of that.
And where do you see the sort of situation now? I think we were, part of the reason for having the discussion last week was that I think it's now been overtaken by New Zealand. But after the 2019 election, the UK Parliament, the House of Commons, was the gayest parliament in the world, with the most out MPs anywhere. As the person who was the sort of the flag bearer right at the beginning, how does that make you feel?
It took 9 years before anyone else joined me in the open. But now it's there are very large numbers of MPs who've had the confidence to come out. I really, really welcome that. And I welcome particularly the fact that it's both lesbians and gay men, that it crosses all the political parties. We still don't have any transgender MPs in Westminster. We've had transgender candidates in recent elections, but no one yet elected. That's the next bit of the glass ceiling to be broken, I think.
Do you think that might happen, you know, within the next general election?
Hopefully, the next general election, certainly within the next couple of general elections, I think it has to happen. And New Zealand were ahead of us in that, I have to say.
You then became, of course, the first gay cabinet minister when you joined the cabinet as culture secretary under Tony Blair. Does it bother you that you're, you know, everything that you do, you've had this sort of first gay MP, first gay cabinet minister, or were you just glad to be in the cabinet?
I was very glad to be in the cabinet, and I think I'm right in saying I wasn't just the first openly gay cabinet minister in the UK, but the first openly gay cabinet minister anywhere in the world. And the rather wonderful thing was virtually no one noticed because it had ceased to be an issue then that I happened to be gay. Because I'd come out 13 years before, here I was in the cabinet, and people started discussing what sort of job I was going to do at being a cabinet minister, rather than making a big fuss about the fact that here was someone who was gay being appointed.
And in terms of the actual day job, what you did as the culture secretary, probably what you always want, every politician wants to feel that they've had some stamp on history. Put to one side your sexuality for the moment. What you did with museums is probably the most well-known thing, making museums free in the UK. Not necessarily totally enthusiastically supported by Tony Blair?
I had to spend quite a bit of time convincing him and convincing Gordon Brown, who was then the Chancellor of the Exchequer, that it was worth doing. Now, of course, Tony regards it as one of the great achievements of his administration.
Of course he does.
and I'm very pleased to say, I mean, it is something I'm really proud of having done.
Yeah, it even cost a Conservative front bench of Hugo Soiree's job, didn't it, when he dared to suggest under David Cameron's early leadership that it was something the Conservatives might look at, and it was... Yeah, it was considered even at that point, untouchable. You were then, you went from being sort of loyal, if slightly, you know, pushy cabinet minister, to then being something more of a rebel. You were one of the leading critics of the push to war in Iraq. To some extent, that all seems like a very long time ago, and yet it's a row and a division which still lingers in the Labour Party now. Did you expect back then that it would still be such a defining issue for your party now?
I probably hadn't expected it would be so lingering an issue. I knew that it was going to be a really significant issue, as in the same way that, for example, the shadow of Vietnam hung over American politics for quite a substantial period of time. The shadow of Iraq has hung over British politics for the whole of the last 18, 19 years. I tabled both the motions that tried to stop us going to war, both in the February and the March of 2003. Again, I have absolutely no regrets about having done that. It was painful to do because I was visibly and prominently criticising my own government. But I just felt that this was absolutely the wrong policy that was being pursued. And there were other options. They hadn't been exhausted. It was the wrong call. I still feel that that was the case.
It was obviously, you know, Tony Blair went on to win the election in 2005, but that was the last election the Labour Party won. Now, what, 16 years ago. When you look at Keir Starmer, given what came next, Gordon Brown, Ed Miliband, then Jeremy Corbyn, when you look at Keir Starmer, has he got what it takes? You were there in the wilderness years of the 1980s of the Labour Party. Is Keir Starmer Tony Blair? Is he Neil Kinnock? Where does he rank in terms of his prospects?
I think Keir has a very good chance of leading the party to victory. He looks and sounds like a prime minister, which is requirement number one. He's very level-headed. He's very decisive. He recognises the need for Labour, if it is going to have a chance of winning an election, to be credible, as well as having passion.
Just to complete your story then, sort of slightly wobbly chronology on this, but like I said, the leader of the rebellion on the Iraq war, he then stood down in the 2005 election. And was at that point that you came out as HIV positive, although you'd been diagnosed many years earlier? Why was it that you only did that after taking the decision to stand down?
I actually did it a few months before I left the House of Commons, but I did know that I was stepping down and I wasn't going to stand again. Someone's health is actually a really personal thing, and for many years I had lived with HIV. It was well under control. Fortunately, medical responses to HIV had developed hugely since I was first diagnosed back in 1987-88. So I'd always seen it as something that was much more private, and I didn't want to go and tell the world about, although I had thought at some point quite possibly I would need to. And I think the actual trigger for it was Nelson Mandela, whose son had just died of AIDS. At his son's funeral, he said, "We need to talk about this. We mustn't hide this any longer. We need to be much more open and honest about HIV and what it's doing, and so on." And I can remember thinking, well, perhaps yes, I ought to. So I did. I did it with the Sunday Times, who were really good at the way in which they decided to run the story. There was a weekend of huge interest and publicity. And I can remember there was a wonderful moment on the Monday morning. I walked back into my office in the House of Commons, and there was a little note sitting on my desk: "Please ring Mr. Mandela," with a telephone number. So I rang this number, which put me straight through to the unmistakable voice of Nelson Mandela, saying he wanted to say thank you to me for what I'd decided to do, and to wish me all the very best. And it was, I have to say, a wonderful moment, and it sort of made it all feel a bit worthwhile.
What an incredible story. And yeah, any other negatives that may have come from that surely outweighed by that. I have to ask you, well, because I basically ask everyone this at the moment, have you watched It's a Sin?
I have indeed watched It's a Sin. I loved it. It was a bit too painfully poignant at times because it's a period I absolutely lived through. It's the period when I was first diagnosed with HIV. I have to say the emotion that I felt at the end most strongly was anger at the way in which so many people wanted to pin a label of shame on people just because of either their medical condition or their sexual orientation. And we've moved way beyond that in the subsequent 20, 30 years. It still hasn't all completely disappeared. And I very much hope that we will get to a point where it has entirely disappeared.
Well, that's it for this episode of Red Box. If you've enjoyed it, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. Maybe even leave us a rating because it helps with the mumbo jumbo charts. We release an episode every day, Monday to Thursday, featuring the best bit of my Times radio show. You can listen to the whole thing Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. It's available on DAB online via smart speaker or on the Times radio app. If you want to read more about all of the stories we've been discussing, then go to times.radio/subscribe.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.